You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network. Visit jabberjawmedia.com for more shows like this one.
So Dewey Halpas is a good friend of mine. He's an old friend of mine, really. Dewey was in a band called Anatomy of a Ghost, and they were pretty much one of the relatively early screamo band that was on Fearless Records. They're from Portland, Oregon, and were part of the scene that was Blood Brothers and Fear Before the March of Flames, Anatomy of a Ghost, and they were around and like a real emerging band when Emory was a local band, and then we looked up to them and stuff, and then we wound up getting to do a tour with them, our second tour we ever did in 2004, our second big real tour. And the Anatomy of a Ghost guys were some of the most fun and crazy and really wild guys. A lot of them moved down from Alaska, and so they saw the world differently and did stuff differently, and we always had a really good connection with them. Back in those days, it was just the early days when everything was wild and fun, and they were in the same spot. And then that band kind of fell apart, and Dewey and I discussed this on the episode today. And then a couple of the guys from that band went on to do the band Portugal the Man. And Portugal the Man has turned out to be a wildly, hugely successful indie band. And so that's great. It's very always happy to see people move on and do bigger and even better things. Now, Dewey now is a podcaster. He's one of my favorite podcasters because he got the perfect work ethic. He applies all the stuff that he knows about guitar. And, you know, Dewey's always been obsessive about restringing guitars and gear and how stuff works. He's a kindred spirit in that way, and now he's a podcaster, and he loves every little aspect of podcasting. He's a real enthusiast about it. And he's quite good at it, too. His podcast is called Peer Pleasure. It's on Jabberjaw Media, so you can find it there. Just search Peer Pleasure Podcast. He gets a lot of great guests, and he's just really good as a host. So he was just somebody that I get to use this platform, my podcast, to be able to talk to about things I'm interested in and what he's interested in and even catch up with him. But he's a stimulating guy, and we have a stimulating conversation. Now, this conversation is brought to you by Broadcast Supply Worldwide. So I'm going to take a little bit of time here and tell you a little bit, even in more detail, about Broadcast Supply and why it's good. So there's these other online retailers that you buy stuff from. It could be Amazon or even one of the music specialty ones. Now, Broadcast Supply is highly specialized, and they specialize not only just in music stuff, but really broadcast. So podcasting, broadcasting, microphones, mic stands, boom arms, interfaces, all that kind of stuff. And in being specialized in that, they know a ton about it. They have a bunch of packages for podcasting equipment. It's something they've paid very much attention to because it's really an emerging industry. And they know more about it, and they have more specific gear for that than any other retailer does. They supply the stuff to most of the big radio stations around the country. And one of my favorite things about them is they have a support staff that on the phone that can talk you through a bunch of your questions about podcasting and how do you hook this up, or do you need a USB mic, or should you use a broadcast mic, and how do you mix it together, and how do you make multiple mics mix and go into Skype, that kind of questions. And they're good at it, and they're there to help you. Their prices are great, competitive or better than anybody else's out there anyway. And the best part about it is you can get 10% off of anything that you buy there if you use my promo code DOWN, DOWN, DOWN. Anything in their podcasting category, which is a ton of stuff, you get 10% off of anyway. They have free shipping for any order that you make that's $99 or over. Their warehouse is right in the middle of the country, so stuff can get to you very quickly. It's really the only place you should buy audio gear from, in my opinion. And I was really happy to get connected with them. It was somebody I worked with at Guitar Center way back in 2001, who's now a big shot over there. And he kind of started listening to podcasts, and we reconnected, and he found out I was doing podcasts and thought it would be a good fit to try to go into that market. And I have to just give him a ton of credit for that, because that's very forward thinking. podcast advertising. I don't know if you know a ton about it, but there's the companies that do it, the big ones that are kind of engineered that way. And then all the, and of course that exists, but it's, there's not a ton of companies that are traditional that are moving into podcast advertising, or at least it's slow moving. And so I give these guys a ton of credit for being forward thinking, trying new ideas, and trying to reach a new market. So I think it's worth supporting. It's not even supporting. I mean, there's nothing to this. It's just the best deal for the best company on the best stuff, and it helps the show out, and you get a discount and free shipping if you spend over $99. So it's very obvious to me, but tell your friends, bookmark this page, bswusa.com, and look there first when you want to know about microphones. They do all these tutorial videos, and they're really good. They have YouTube videos embedded right on their site that answer a ton of your questions, because I get podcast questions constantly. This is who I would ask if I didn't already know the answer, and you know, they'll don't ask me, ask them and buy stuff from them. That's the point. And I appreciate them sponsoring the show, and it really pays the rent in the studio that I'm in. So I can't thank them enough, and I mean that with all sincerity. So thank you to Brian and everybody at Broadcast Supply Worldwide for, you know, helping propel this experiment of the Break It Down podcast forward. I won't take much of your time else on anything else today other than to tell you that Emory has some shows up. And if you really do want to support, that's emorymusic.com. And if you want to support this show, if you're listening to the show for free, I'd ask that you would consider supporting it and contributing to it with some of your money. I think it will, you'll be invited to join our Slack community where we hang out and talk about stuff. And I just think it's better to pay for the media that you consume. And I think the future will be largely that way. So it's better to just be forward thinking on that and pay as you go. I mean, it's no problem for people that want to take the show free. I hope 10,000 more people listen to the show for free. No hard feelings whatsoever. But I would suggest to you that being an active participant, joining the community, and directly supporting the media that you consume in whatever way you can is the way to go. I think it is the way that the future will go, and it's how the whole thing will work, that we get media that is created for us to consume that has our best interest in mind. So I would suggest you should go to my website or Patreon page and support the Break It Down podcast. And my website is breakitdownpod.com. So go check that out if you don't mind. And all right, let's talk to Dewey.
Break it down, Dada.
Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh.
Dewey Halpas, sitting in your car on your lunch break podcasting with me.
Yes, sir.
That's a funny thing.
Sitting in the car I took my driving test in when I was 16, and I'm 34.
You have the same car as you had when you were 16?
Yeah, I got it from my dad. The van I was driving, the side door, I got the van for free from a buddy. After I started having kids, he's like, hey, you need a van, I'm getting a truck. And the side door fell off. So my dad's like, hey, I still got the Dodge, you want to take that? And I was like, sure. So it's still running.
You're in a Dodge van from what year?
This is a 95 Dodge Spirit. The van I had the door fall off, so that's sitting up at my folks in Seattle right now.
Oh,
so,
I see.
Yeah, that's I'm against funny. Having a car payment, I guess. So I just,
well,
drive with it.
You know, I am against having a car payment too. In fact, specifically, that's one of the big principles of my financial life is like, okay, there's lots of stuff to spend money on. There's tons of stuff that we spend money on, more than a car payment would even be, probably childcare, for instance. But but I've never had a car payment, and I just don't think anybody should. I think it's great. I wish I had a Porsche or something. You know what car I wish I had was a brand new white Corvette. I would never drive it. I'd be so embarrassed if I had a nice car. So part of it is I would be so embarrassed if I had a nice car. I just would be. But I love cars. But I think it's great if people have nice cars, if you can afford it. And you can afford a nice car if you can pay cash for one. That's,
sure.
That's all good.
Yeah.
That's just the way I think about it. So I don't – I mean, I try to get a car that's usually worth around $10,000, and then I trade it when it gets to be worth $5,000 or $6,000, and then I try to pay an extra $4,000 or $5,000 to keep up. And that's basically my system on how to buy cars is whatever. So we have a two SUVs, and that's what we got. And I try to keep our nice car is a $10,000 SUV with 170,000 miles on it. That's worth about $8,000 now. And when it starts to get worth about $5,000, I'll sell it and get something else.
Sure.
And save up the cash. So that's good.
Yeah, coming from touring life, man, you appreciate what you have for sure.
And
you're a lot easier to get around.
Yes.
You know, something gets you point A to point B, it doesn't matter what it looks like necessarily.
Well, that's a good point, Dewey. It's a function. Touring and DIY touring especially teaches you functionality and practicality and pragmatism, at least. Like, it's so pragmatic how you tour. There's so many things you do on tour that you just would most people would never do or seem goofy or wrong, and it's just a purely utility thing. And you know, it's a kind of good lessons, I think.
It's survival, man. You find out what you're made of. You find out, you know, who you are. I mean, I think everyone should. I've said it on my show before. I think everyone, when they turn, 18, they should put off college and throw some money at them. Let them go find themselves for 6 months, and get some perspective and some
worldview. How would you do that? I mean, touring's easy. First of all, if you could go on tour, that is good, you're saying, first of all, for young people.
Absolutely. I think just going out and finding yourself, being away from home, being self-sufficient as far as here's a certain amount of money, you got to make this last. Because with touring, when we started touring, it was $3 a day, and we'd go to McDonald's, and we would get a McChicken sandwich, which was $1. We'd get a side salad, and we'd get a cup for water and a small fry. And we'd take the fries, put them on the bun from the chicken sandwich, cut up the chicken, put it on the side salad. And it felt like you were having a gourmet meal.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you just had to get inventive with what you had. And, that kind of thing. Like, just surviving. I mean, it's a big deal. And a lot of people don't have any idea how to do that.
Well, I don't know what you're saying, though, you would do for a young person if they didn't have the opportunity to tour. How would they find themselves, let's say? Or
I think it would be awesome to have a government-funded program that would give you, here's $2,000 when you turn 18 to go out and do what you want to do as far as traveling. Go out, do what you can do. Kind of thing where people, sometimes young people come into some money, inheritance or whatever, and they go on a road trip for, three or 4 months.
So, I think that to get this $2,000 grant, though, you would have to, you couldn't be at home. You just must stay out of your state, at least, right, to collect.
Correct.
It. Yeah.
Correct.
That's not so bad. I'm not into government entitlements much, but I do think that's a reasonable idea. I'm okay with the problem with government stuff is it's typically de-incentivizing. So if you could get the incentives correct, there's nothing wrong with spending government money to move people in a direction that they ought to go. But incentivizing people to not move is just horrible to me. But I don't know if this is a real idea or not, but I like it. I like the thought process behind it.
Yeah, I mean, here's $2,000. Take 2 months, go out and do it. I mean, $2,000 is pocket change, but go out, do your thing, and come back. Teach people what you found out about yourself or lessons you've learned. We'll double that towards your college tuition. Or something like that. Incentivize it that way. But
no,
it's just
like
a pipe
that.
Dream. It's just an idea I came up with on one of my shows, the amount of perspective and worldview we gather from touring is priceless.
That's what I'm trying to get at is I wonder if there's what are the other best ways to get it. So people talk about backpacking in Europe, and I was spending $12 a day and eating bread and olive oil and vinegar in Italy, and it was I just had a backpack and slipped in this hostel or with this family for $4 or something. Like, that's the same kind of thing, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly the same thing. Just finding yourself.
Could you do that in the U.S.? What would somebody do if they had $2,000 or $3,000 and they lived in Arizona? So they're no longer allowed in Arizona. So they get different amounts of money. They had to check in at different points. They could not just go to another state and camp out either. They had to be on the move.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It'd be like Amazing Race, kind of.
Yeah, you had to take Greyhounds and things like that.
Sure. Yeah. You couldn't just get a car and drive. Like, you'd need to make your way, find your way, they could even take you, drop you off, and you find your way home. That's
and then make it a TV show to recoup some of the entitlement money. Well,
exactly.
The other thing that's utility about touring is, so we have a bus that we own, and I don't know if you've ever seen our bus, but we've eventually grabbed it. We started in vans and all that stuff, and now we have an 84, basically it is a Greyhound bus that we have and have retrofitted. Now, We didn't make this a luxury bus. And part of the thing that I'm most proud about the thing is it's so utility. Like people walk on a bus, they say, it's a tour bus, and they expect it to be wood paneling and flat screen TVs and stuff. Like, we don't have any of that stuff. It's the original floor from the Greyhound bus in 1984. And then it's some little couches we put in. We did camping chairs for a long time as the furniture inside the bus. Because, you know, you sit in park, you ever be on tour and you sit in a parking lot and camping chairs, how wonderful that is. Like,
yeah,
it's best thing to be in a Walmart parking lot with camping chairs and that unfold, and you can. And so we just would put them in the bus. We just did it minimalist and left the front space open. We built bunks in the back, and we'd sit in camping chairs. You can sit wherever you want. You can sit in a circle. You can sit facing the front. You can sit near the driver. You can go over and work on your laptop, and it's just great. And it feels like you're just, you know, it has nothing to do with aesthetics at all. It's not impressing somebody. It's not some show off company leasing you a nice goofy bus. This thing's huge. You can do whatever you want in it. It takes us from gig to gig. It's utility. It feels good. It's like camping. It's problem solving. It's awesome.
And you own it. You're not paying that $2,000 a day. You don't have to worry about it. Do you pay a driver or do,
nope,
do one of you guys drive?
Of course not. What are you, crazy? Driver's $200 a day plus a hotel room and his cab back and forth to the hotel. That's more than we make a day. I can't have a driver making more than we make in a day.
Sure. The only time I've been on your bus was when you were renting a bus.
Yeah,
that was on the Question Tour.
Oh,
that was a long time
ago. We were flush with cash back then, Dewey.
Yeah, you guys were hitting it hard.
Well, I know that we weren't flush with cash. We just spent it all for a while, but we didn't have the experience and the knowledge and stuff. You know what I mean? Like that came with time. But the purest parts were like when we were first touring together, Anatomy of Ghosts and Emery. Y'all played the main support slot, and we were the second band on that tour, and you were the main support to Beautiful Mistake. That was the second tour we'd ever done.
Yeah, that was that was awesome tour, because that's when you really saw things change, because it was a full U.S. and basically by the second half we realized, and I think we even talked about it, like, you guys should be playing after us because you guys were blowing up.
Yeah,
and you know I don't know how we got the main support slot on that tour, and I mean that tour was an awesome tour, but it was a weird lineup, and everyone was going nuts for you guys, and then you know we go on afterwards, and it almost felt like. I'd say before halfway that you guys needed to be playing after us in the main support slot. But at that point we were just, that's the tour we pretty much were like breaking up on.
Yeah.
So I remember in Texas riding in your guys' van and talking about it, because we're like, I was like, dude, my band is ending and I'm the only one who doesn't want it to end. And you guys are like, well, why don't you just keep going? And I was like, well, that's a great question, because I didn't write a lot of the stuff. You know, it's mainly John's music, and so I'd feel weird doing that. And I never went on with it, but that was our last tour.
Yeah, I think it might have been Beautiful Mistake's last tour. I hadn't thought about that in a really long time, but you're right, because our record came out, and we got on the Tooth and Nail Tour. It was our first tour, and we were the opener on that tour. And we had fans from the day the record came out, which was awesome. And then it took a little time for us to... You know, we were selling a few thousand records a week, but the weeks just kept going and going and going, you know, and the word of mouth and stuff. So this was the second tour. So this is a few months into our first release, and it was like, here it goes. And it didn't feel that crazy at the time, but that probably was true by the end of that tour, where we might have been the big of draw. People would leave before the headliner even a lot, you know.
A lot of people would leave after we played.
Yeah, exactly. And then the next tour we did after that... We did a couple tours after that where it was the same thing or even worse. We did a few tours where it was like we were main support or something, and it was like everybody would leave after we would play, which is a really cool time. It's not the situation anymore. But, you know, that's not that bad a thing. Like, that's what you want, is when you want a main support. That's a good get if you get a main support band that can outdraw you. It's like, hell yeah. You know, that's not you.
Yeah.
Don't complain about that. When we first started headlining, we were looking for main support bands. We'd always had trouble getting them. And then finally, we're like, okay, these bands are selling like 1,000 a week. They're both brand new bands. I never heard of these stupid bands, but whatever. And it was, you got to pick. Here's the two you have. There's a band called Day to Remember and a band called Mayday Parade. And we, for whatever reason, wound up just picking Mayday Parade. And it was like, all right, just some band. Sounds like they're going to be okay. And then they were just, I mean, obviously both of those would have destroyed unbelievable. But Day to Remember probably would have been even better. And I sure do wish we'd have chosen them, just in the sense that I would know them and have a little more access to them, and maybe they'd taken us on tour later. But we, you know, we've never really played with them or know them. I'm sure we know each other, but we've never played together. But Mayday Parade was awesome, but they outdrew us a lot of nights. It was like, oh wow, people are leaving after they played, but still good. The shows were every show was amazing back then. But we didn't take any money home.
We did a show
back then. We were spending all that bus money, is what we were talking about. But
yeah, we played a show with. This is funny because before that tour, we were doing a tour. I forget. No, maybe it was. It was with you guys. It was that tour. We combined that tour with My Chemical Romance and Avenged Sevenfold.
That's right.
In Dallas.
That's right.
And we ended up playing after My Chemical Romance.
That's right.
Before Avenged Sevenfold.
It was at the
Gypsy
Ballroom.
And then they both became the biggest band in the world.
Yeah. It was Gypsy Ballroom. We played down the street in San Antonio at the same night. And then the next night we went to Dallas, and they just said, well, we better combine these shows. And there was this band called My Chem that was supporting this hardcore band from Orange County called Avenged Sevenfold. I didn't know either band, really.
Yep.
And I mean, I'd heard of both bands, but they weren't. Neither one of them were significant. They were the same size as our tour. Our tour was a little bit smaller than theirs, and our tour was pretty small overall. Both tours were doing 400 or 500 people a night, basically.
Yeah, yeah, and they're falling in the same towns, and and we played with them and Avenged on Warped Tour, and we did that Warped Tour on the Kevin Says stage.
Uh-huh.
Where we got bumped up to our main stage slot, which we slept in Portland. Kevin threw us on main stage as a favor. And we slept in and missed the show.
Oh, for real?
It was amazing. Yeah, that was amazing.
That's crazy. Yeah, yeah, and then when we did Warped Tour, Avenged and Mike Kim were the headliners on that in 2005. Oh, it was just a year later. That must have been so fast. It was just a year later, and they were the biggest bands you could ever imagine just a year later.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think they're all worth millions of dollars now. It's insane.
You know,
they hit right at the right time before all the downloading.
Yeah, no, yes, they absolutely did. And they deserve it. Those bands are good. I mean, they do the right stuff. I mean, it's you know, they get what they're worth for sure in that regard as far as what they're doing. And Anatomy just fell apart?
Yeah, Anatomy just fell apart. Basically, it started as we had a few tours that we bailed on just because John and Joe would get in a fight in, say, North Carolina, and then be like, all right, you know what, we're not going to continue this tour. So John would climb underneath the bunk in the van, and Joe would sit in the front seat, and we drove all the way back from North Carolina straight. And the Fear Before guys were on that tour, and they continued it and went on. But then we went back out on tour again, and eventually Nick was like, I just want to go home and work a day job. I don't want to do this anymore. And Joe's kind of the same way. And then John and Zach wanted to do Portugal the Man. And at that point, I was pissed because I was like, man, this is it. We had, like, major labels bidding on us. Our management was like, just do not break up right now. And they're like, yeah, we don't care. And I was like, are you guys serious? We can be set for life at least, you know, for a while. And we worked so hard on this and had so many great opportunities that we jumped on and helped out. But man, it was crazy. And then all of a sudden it was like I think it was Dallas maybe. They're basically like, yeah, that's it. That's the end. We'll do a last show in Portland, and that's it. And it was just crazy. It was because I was literally like the only one that was like, no, let's keep doing this. And I was pissed about the whole thing. So when they're like, you want to, you know, do something with Portugal the Man, it's a side project John wanted to start. I was like, no, I don't want to be involved with that. I want to do this. You know, I was still a kid at the time, and had no idea where Portugal would go after that. And it was just literally acoustic.
Yeah, I remember at the time I was doing that.
And I was like, I like playing aggressive music. Like, I don't want to play this stuff. And then a few years after that, they called me up and said, hey, we got some shows with Dredge. Do you want to come out and play? And I was like, yeah, sure, let's do it. And I came over and learned the set and went down and played with Dredge and just kept playing with them for a few years.
Uh-huh.
Going on with me, touring with Poison Well and stuff, and had some crazy awesome tours, and going to Europe, that was awesome too. But that was the extent of it. Like, it was just like a weird ride.
Yeah.
Did, absolutely. But
that, I mean, I don't think anybody saw the Portugal, the Man thing coming to be as big as it is. I don't even know if I have a grip on it. I just am always confused. I was like, is that band, that's John's band is what doing what now? I mean, I just can't believe it. Like, I don't even know how to.
They're number one.
At what?
They just hit number one for Feel but still, that new single on the Billboard AAA radio charts.
That's crazy.
It's insane. Like, it's absolutely insane. And they just released a new single today on Spotify, which is awesome. And they did so many songs for that record and recorded with several producers, Danger Mouse, Mike D from the Beastie Boys, and just spent so long recording it and finally decided on, you know, the 10 songs they want. And it's fantastic. It's a fantastic record. And but yeah, it's to see where they're at now and then going over to John's house and just, you know, hanging out or Zach's place and being like, I just saw you on TV.
Yeah.
You know, it's surreal.
Yeah.
But they worked hard. I mean, they worked really hard to get there.
Well, it's no offense, but it's way better. At least John is way better in that band than he was in your band. I didn't ever it was the right thing for, I always thought he was, I don't know how to describe this, but John, here's the thing about what John was doing there. It was pretty important, but I never thought it sounded that good. So I know that's a weird thing to say, so let me untangle it. I never understood, and to this day, don't actually like heavy music with that high singing. But John was the first person one of the first people to do that. So I think Seosin was there like that, close, but it's no difference. Like Anthony Green and John was doing that, and then Chiodos and stuff like that, and then on and on from there. But I never understood that. It seemed to not match to me, that high singing, heady voice stuff, and didn't seem to match aggressive music. Now, I'm wrong about that because it's huge and people love it. But I always felt like it sounded disconnected to me. Like that singing, first of all, I can't tell what key he's in or the band is in. I've always felt like it was hard to hear or hard for him to hear. I didn't know if he was a good singer or a bad singer. It was just so foreign to me of what he was doing. It's more foreign to me at the time, which means it was actually out there than I was picking up on. And maybe it was just a little ahead of its time in aggressive music, or maybe it could have gotten better, or maybe it would have made more sense if y'all had hung on. I mean, it really might have. It might have been like Anthony Green and John and Circus Survive and Anatomy of a Ghost. Who knows what it could have been. But it's certainly much more understandable to me in Portugal the Man what he does. I put it that way.
Sure.
And he's amazingly talented, and I didn't know that he was at the time. I put it that way. He's amazingly talented, and I toured with him and thought, I don't guess he's any good, is what I thought at the time. So no offense to your band, but it was a good band. I liked the music. I just didn't think the singer was that good. And now I think, holy shit, that guy's an amazing talent.
He is, and he didn't know who he was at the time.
Yeah.
And I told him flat out, I was like, dude, you got to stop singing this falsetto. It's out of key.
Right.
And he would get pissed, and so would I. And we almost got in fist fights in some stores, like on tour, over this stuff, just arguing about things like, dude, just don't do the falsetto stuff. And he knew what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
He just wasn't there yet.
He wasn't quite the right package for it. But
yeah.
And maybe that could have worked out if y'all didn't break up and all that stuff. But it's what he's doing now. It obviously works. But
yeah. Well, he took a lot of the lyrics from the second Anatomy record we haven't released. And it wasn't ever recorded. It's all demoed.
Uh-huh.
And we had John Goodmanson lined out to do it at Robert Lang. And the label, Fearless, hated it. They hated the record. They said it's just a bunch of parts. And of course it was.
That's exactly what it was. Yeah.
And so the no support from the label also really put attention on John and us, because it's like the label doesn't like it, you know, and not that we necessarily cared, but it was just another nail in the coffin that was like, okay, people don't really believe in this. And you know, we thought it was great. John Goodmanson came down and made a ton of notes, and then when we ended up breaking up, the Blood Brothers ended up taking our studio time to record Crimes so with John Goodmanson, and so that was kind of cool to see that at least it got used up. But we still have those demos, and you can hear a lot on there where John was really struggling to find his voice. But then hearing those songs done with Portugal, it made complete sense.
Yeah. And so, I mean, they're doing, is John rich now?
No.
How do you get that big and not have a bunch of money?
Well,
because he seems like a normal guy.
A couple weeks ago. He is absolutely. And we talked about this. I was doing some plumbing over at his house, and I basically sat him down. I was like, dude, are you happy? Like, are you happy with where you're at? I mean, your things are going a million miles an hour, you know? And he said, yeah, I think so. You know, and we talked about his access. He has access to anyone.
Yeah.
You know, like, and how that affects him and things like that. But when I said, man, if you guys just had the one hit single And I made a joke about Harvey Danger, I think, who happened to be roommates with Kyle back in the day. And they said, no, he's not rich either. They're like, if this was Anatomy days and we were this big, we would have tons of money.
Uh-huh.
But now with no one buying records or anything else, and they don't do like the VIP stuff or anything like that. I mean, they're making a salary every week. And then everything else goes into their business manager's hands and does what he will. And they have salary lined out, I believe, for 3 years, like backup salary. So if the band said they don't want to do it anymore, they still get the salary for 3 years. And then at that point, they get the rest of the money. But they're not.
So there is a lot of money somewhere, but it's still not near the amount that you would think it would be.
There's a substantial amount of money, but it's not. That's between all those people. And they pay everyone the same on tour, from the merch guy to John.
No way.
The same amount when they're touring. It's the way they've always done it.
That's cool.
I really respect that.
Well, that's kind of conservative to have that salary thing and stuff lined out, you know. But at the same time, they're in a big major label system, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the money goes a ton of different ways. Like, there's millions of dollars generated, no doubt. I mean, there's millions of dollars generated in total. But that's a fraction of what would have been generated, you know, 10 years ago. But still largely, I mean, yeah, the way it gets cut with the labels and the managers and the agents, and you're right, they when you're that big, there's this other phenomenon that happens, and it's the opposite of what where we're at for the most part. But you have to reinvest your money because of the there's some amount of perception being reality and things that you have to do. You can't just take all the money and put it in your pocket. You are a real thing. It's like a company couldn't do that. It's not like Apple has $500 billion in cash. Well, they don't split it up. It doesn't go to the CEO. Tim Cook doesn't take it home. It's you cannot, at a high level, you cannot think that way. You can only think future opportunity and reinvestment and how to make it stay where it is and operate at a high level. You can't get that way about it. So in an ironic way, smaller bands like us are able to, like, per size we are and what we maximize in dollars is actually really, really good. But we're able to. And it's still really inefficient. I mean, I still feel like the amount of money we totally generate that actually goes into my family's pocket is still unbelievably small, but that's probably nothing compared to big bands with millions of dollars generated that still wind up with just, I bet their tax returns are like meager. I'm sure it is.
Yeah. And I mean, John bought a house, and I don't know how much delve into this, but John went to buy a house. And, you know, plenty of, you know, income to substantiate buying a house, like making a house payment, everything. He wasn't going to go pay cash, of course, couldn't pay cash. But when he walked in to get his loan, they're like,
good luck.
Yeah, we can't. Yeah. You need a cosign, which is weird because then, of course, they're like, we know who you are.
Yeah.
But your job.
The computer tells us, no, I know who you are.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of your band. I saw you on TV yesterday. But the computer says no on this one.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Right. So, you know, he had, you know, have to have co-signer on the house with his dad, I believe. And which is just funny because you think you see people on magazines and everything else and you think they have the life. And they do have a pretty awesome job, but at the same time, there's still basic life struggles that can get you, you know, get you going. And that's one of them, like just not being able to go in and apply for a loan because your income is so staggered, you know.
Yeah. And not guaranteed.
You know,
that's what they don't like about it is they go, okay, so you might not sell any records next week for all we know. I mean, you don't have a guaranteed anything. Yeah. So that's the problem.
Exactly.
There.
But they're smart with their money, and that's going to be really good for them in the end because, I mean, they're not going to have a retirement. I mean, it's not like they're earning a pension or anything.
Yeah.
You know, so, but yeah, they've done really well and taking care of their money and being frugal where it counts, and then also knowing what needs to be done to get the record they want out. You know, because they have good budgets on these records.
That's right.
And that's a lot of recoupment, so.
Yeah, that's true. And so how do you find being alternatively doing plumbing?
Yeah, I love it, man. It's something I didn't know about. Like I applied at the hall and took 2.5 years to get in because of that crash, 2008 and everything, all the work stopped.
Uh-huh.
And then when I got into it, it was kind of like with music where you're building something from the ground up. You start with a seed you know, you see your work done at the end of the day. You're not, you know, sitting on a computer you know, the same things there when you got there as when you left. I mean, you're putting something together and it's an important trade. I mean, being able to see the importance of what I do helps me do it every day.
And you're doing plumbing at a commercial level.
Yes. Yes. So right now I'm building two hospitals, cancer hospitals down here in Portland. Worked out at Nike for a while, doing their new fitness center where the Blazers opponents will practice, things like that. There's cool opportunities with it. And the money's great for, you know, a living wage.
Yeah.
As far as supporting my family and stuff. And it's fun, you know.
And so you're getting to be involved in the design of the systems and all that stuff.
Yep, yep. I've taken a role detailing now on this hospital to where we're working on designing the systems before they go in, basically creating them on CAD and those programs. So that was a whole new ball game as well. But also frees me up, you know, physically. I'm a lot less tired at the end of the day when I go home to play with the kids and stuff and put all my energy into podcasting after that. I mean, that's something that's taken off quite a bit. I didn't anticipate to be that much work as it's become, but it definitely takes up the rest of my time.
Yeah,
which drives my wife nuts. But
yeah. I bet that is hard. So the and I'll move from plumbing here in a second, but I am interested in trades themselves.
I like
about trades is there's this really conceptual level that is very attractive to me. Like, work is fine. I'm not interested in being a laborer, ditch digger, or anything like that, but I'm very attracted to, you know, pouring concrete and the forms and foundations and plumbing systems and the air compressor system on our bus and hydraulic systems on heavy equipment. Like, I just cannot help it. I'm just, you know, naturally extremely fascinated with those things and find myself spending time thinking about it for no reason. And so in those regards, I think the trades are really interesting. Electrical, of course, is very – I love residential and commercial electrical. I know that's silly, but I'll just look at it everywhere I go and think about it. But You enjoy it that way. It's not like, oh, Dewey's band failed and now he fixes toilets, right? It's not that.
No. That's the best part is commercial plumbing. You make $10 more an hour than the people that do the shitty pipe working on houses doing service.
Yeah.
To put in all new stuff. And you learn the science behind it.
Right.
Then you're basically making yourself worth what you're making. I mean, it's a learned trade. It's a 5-year apprenticeship program. And, I mean, I don't know anywhere that will start you at what we make straight out of college, basically,
absolutely,
which is straight out of the apprenticeship.
That's awesome.
And it's something that's going to last. And it's helping out, you know, I mean, working on a cancer hospital. I mean, how much more worth can you feel in your job? You know, you're putting in a system, you're putting in a med gas system that's going to save a child's life in a NICU. You know, both my kids were in the NICU. And a plumber put that med gas together that saved their life.
I love that. Yeah,
it's important. You know, it's awesome. It circles around, and I know it's sentimental, kind of, but when I'm working on that stuff, I'm thinking about those people, you know, that are going to need it. You know, it's a good trade. I like it a lot.
Yeah. So, but what if you had to work on something that was negative? Like, what if you had to do plumbing in a new white power center? You know, think about it. They're building a new, but it's double time pay.
Yeah. I'd have to think of it as maybe once they get shut down, someone else is going to really need this building.
So you'd falsely wire the gas line in that one so that it would blow up.
Yeah. Or I'd plumb it backwards so it backed up into the,
Well, you know, it's amazing where I come from, because where I come from is actually my dad owned and always had a construction business, a grading and paving business. So I grew up on site work with bulldozers and paving machines and stuff like that. My earliest memories are that and heavy equipment and all that kind of stuff. So he ran a business that did that for most of his whole life, which I chose not to go into, but something about it just feels so natural and home to me that I miss it a little bit. But my parents never guilted me or said, you need to go into this business or take it over or anything like that. I really appreciate that. And part of it was that whole business, it wasn't seen as like great, like especially the laborers, they made nothing an hour. And even the equipment operators and the people doing trades where I'm from, at least in the 80s and at that time, it wasn't, I mean, plumbers were fixed toilets and they didn't make much money. That was the way it felt and seemed. And now I live here in Seattle in the whatever year it is now, and I know all these blue collar in air quotes, workers. And I didn't actually make the air quotes. I just said air quotes. That's funny. But they, these blue collar people that you run into, and they're tough, and they're like, just, oh, the blue collar people. And then I think, and I see them pull up in their, you know, 2017 Toyota Tundra truck. I'm like, that's a $50,000 truck. I mean, back to the car thing, and they can afford it. And I'm just like, I could never afford that truck. And I think about Wes, I said, wait a second. I'm a professional entertainer and international rock star, whatever it is I am. And no doubt about it, you and all those people make more money than me, for sure. Like, just people that work, that do electrical. And it's like, oh, wow, that's a, that's kind of a dip. I mean, like, and I don't, that's what I'm saying. I don't disrespect it. I almost fundamentally like that stuff. And I just, but I always never thought of that as something that would be good or okay money-wise. But it's astonishing how much the tradesmen's make. And it's great. Yeah. And I think that's where everybody should gravitate towards, because they're so good. That to welding, to medical technicians, all that stuff. That's great, man. Mm-hmm. Please. Go. Yeah. Don't go to college to get a humanities degree or whatever stupid shit that is. Yeah. At least, I mean, get training. Focus on training, not degrees of whatever bullshit. But I mean, that stuff can be great. And they make good money. Make more than I do, guaranteed.
Yeah, plumbers and electricians make the most of any trades out there, besides elevator constructors, and they're usually within a dollar an hour of each other, depending on when their contract negotiations happen. And that's why I signed up for both. I signed up for electrical and for plumbing, and plumbing came first. So, it's
where did
awesome.
You get that advice, or the you know, how did you know to do that?
Well, I looked it up. Basically, I looked at carpenters, and there's a joke: what's the difference between a carpenter and a plumber? Are about $10 an hour. So whenever the contract or the carpenters are giving you shit, like, you'd always bring that joke out, because they make about $10 less. So I was looking at it, I was like, man, the two top paid trades are electrical and plumbing. The only reason electrical or elevator constructors make more is because there's only like four or five shops in town, and they're all union. With plumbing, there's so many non-union plumbing shops that it drives everything down a little bit more. So with the elevator constructors, that's the top. And there's like 2,000 people that do that, and it's
hard to get
into. It's very hard to get into.
Yeah.
But yeah, with plumbing, I just had a buddy in the trade that said, hey, the hall's opening up for the apprenticeship, you should sign up. And I was like, dude, I'll do it. And it just took forever. So I had another baby, and I went to college and got my associates during that 2.5 year period before they called me back. And and I've just been doing this ever since, and I'm not using my college degree at all.
You know, I'm always worry about, or think about, I don't know if I really worry about it, but we often discuss it, like, oh, these bands that aren't bands anymore, and you just don't get the best feeling about where some of those people's futures are going to be. Do you know what I mean? Like, bands don't last forever. Mine happens to be around, but that's obviously a fluke. But, you know, the bands aren't going to last forever, and the bass player and this band or that band, I'm not going to say any names, of course, but you're like, oh gosh, what is that guy going to do? And I almost get this sense that it's worse for them having, in some ways it's better having had experiences, but in some level, when people go out of band life or something cool or glamorous, they tend to not want to move on correctly sometimes, but you seem to have gotten with that. Is that hard, or how do you feel about that situation of being able to let something go to move on to the next thing?
Well, it's ironic, because touring taught me to let things go quickly, and whether it's girlfriends, you know, possessions, things like that, where we had to drop everything and go on tour. It was hard the first time, but it got easier every time I had to do that. Like, all right, well, I'm not going to have room for this, so I'll just sell it or give it to Goodwill. Like, mostly material things. They got good at leaving that behind. So when it came time to stop playing music, it was fairly easy to leave that behind. I was like, you know, I've been here, here, and here. I'm starting to recognize Chevron bathrooms. I mean, I'm done with the rat race. But it's time to get an actual job and move on. And it always felt like, I feel like I've gotten the best of both worlds. When we were touring all the time, I'd come home, friends, hey, what'd you do, you know, while I was gone? And, oh, I graduated college, or I had a baby, or got married. You know, they're progressing. And then they're like, what'd you do? And I was like, I played the same 10 songs over and over again, in different cities, which is awesome. I'm not putting it down, but at the same time, now I'm getting to experience the other part, going to college, getting married, having kids, having a job, you know, working towards something that you can make last your lifetime. you know, much less than music. And if I wanted to do music, I mean, I could easily, you know, do it, but there just wasn't enough certainty in it for me to, you know, with my kids say, you know what, let's give this a shot, because I wasn't into it the same way as I was when I was younger.
Well,
you know, I've got different priorities now. So
it may be even more difficult, the amount of success you have. I mean, there's probably a situation where you become unemployable. Let's say Ben Gibbard went to see a psychic and they said, you cannot do music anymore. He became convinced that music was not for him anymore. Although, of course, he could make money doing it, whatever. What job could he go do? You know, like, he can't, what's he going to do? Work at a place? I mean, it would be so, even if he wanted to or had some skill, it just would be, what are you doing? You're head of a car dealership or something? I mean, I don't know what you even could do. You know, regardless of you, what are you going to be? Just a software engineer next to the next guy, Ben Gibbard, or something? I don't know.
You'd have to stay in music. Like with when I was talking to the Thrice guys when they went on that hiatus. Like Eddie started working for a management company, managing bands. Riley went to tech for Weezer and Jimmy Eat World.
Yeah, but see, like, that's what I'm saying. That's okay, and it makes sense, and it might be a good decision. But it almost feels like that's holding you back at that point.
Sure.
I don't think that sounds great to me. I mean, maybe Riley wants to be a tech forever. My guess is not. He's happier to be back in Thrice playing again.
Yeah.
Even though at the time he's probably like, fuck this, we're done. I'm pretty sure. I don't know him. You do. But, you know, it seems to me like he's like, well, I have to, you feel trapped now. Like, I have to be around the power of the thing, or I need to be in this, or this is all I know. I can't move on. Like, I think that's not, that doesn't usually seem like a good thing. And then that was part of what feeds into why every band comes back or does a reunion or figures shit out, because you just, you can't get away from it, you know.
We talked about, I had Adam from Fear Before on the show, and Fear Before was going to get together and do a tour this year, which I don't think is going to happen now, but he was joking, and we were joking, like, if we got Bear vs. Shark, since they're back together somewhat, and then get Anatomy to get back together and go out. And I was like, you know what, I'd probably do that for one tour, a couple weeks or something like that, just for fun. But it would never be a money grab issue or like a, you know, 20th anniversary or 10th anniversary of the record and play it all the way through kind of thing. But that'll never happen.
but you found something pretty healthy, and I would draw a through line through this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're obsessed, like really obsessed with podcasting. And to me, that's a different, like maybe it has to fill that media creation or creative or something void that you must, I mean, there must be something of you that misses touring or would have had it. And this has to be somewhat of a replacement for that, right?
Sure. It's definitely, I was talking to my wife before I did it. I was like, you know, I'm thinking I could maybe do this. And it's a way to stay connected with buddies from the music industry that I've had forever.
Yeah.
You know, but still be creative. But at this time, instead of riding a train that I wasn't driving, like with Anatomy or Portugal, where I was playing someone else's music pretty much, I'm responsible for this. So every like on Twitter, every, you know, awesome comment or 5-star rating on the show is for something that I've put together. And I really feel a lot more value for me in that, because it's, in, you know, and more responsibility to provide something that I feel proud of, you know, versus in music where I just had to go out and play every night.
Yeah.
This I have to actually prepare for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's cool. It's a cool medium. It's unregulated. We can put out whatever we want. We can say what we want. We can talk to who we want. You know, there's no rules, really. I mean, there's basic guidelines you want to follow to stay consistent with formatting and stuff. But other than that, it's just a free market. It's awesome.
Yeah, it is. But you get something. I mean, it satisfies something to be able to be doing that for sure, right? Like you don't make money from it really, or not a lot, or not yet, and all that kind of stuff. But that's, I mean, the amount of work I see you put into it, and we've talked about it, is clearly something you're not doing for its any kind of direct return other than the process itself, which is, gosh, I just can't. I just wish people had that view like the way that you do. That's just the best way to do it.
Well, I appreciate that, man. And that's, and you were a big part of that too. When I called you up, I was like, hey, can you chat for a little while? I have these questions. And it's funny listening to you and Ray go back and forth about podcasts and the mistakes people make in the beginning, because I was pretty much doing all of those. So I was like, man, what about ads? And what about this? And what? And you're like, no. Just get out there. And when you told me that picture, say you had 150 people listen to your episode, and you walked out your back door, and they were all standing there.
Yeah.
And said, hey, and you could see them.
Yeah.
How cool that would feel.
Yeah.
And then thinking about that when you see how many listens you're getting to, you know, people are listening to you. It's cool.
Yeah, 150 is great.
And that was a cool perspective.
Whatever it is, but.
It's definitely more than that. But when you were using the analogy, it was like, picture 150 people in your backyard.
Oh, yeah, no, I know your show's bigger than 150. I'm just saying people that have shows, even 150 people listen. I mean, that's more people than you know. That's more than, I mean, you're a local band plays and you get 12 people to come. I've done it a million times. You know, it's your family, your aunt, and whoever else. So if you can get a podcast going, 212 people tune in and listen that you didn't have to guilt into doing this, that you're off and running. Enjoy it. You know?
Yeah.
There you go. Congratulations is what you should say. So I don't know. That's one way that I think about it. But you are a process guy, and that's the important thing. You can't get good at something unless you're that way. Like, and it gets harder and harder in a way too. It's really similar to guitar playing. Like, everybody plays guitar, and most people actually get pretty good. But it's not because they have an end in mind. That's not how you get good at guitar. You don't say, shit, I've got to practice guitar for the next 8 years for 2 hours a day so that I can get what I want. That's almost nobody that's good at guitar thinks that way. It'd be absolute horrible risk-reward strategy. It would be horrible enjoyment-wise. It would be very, very little chance you'd have success. It would not feel good. It'd be horrible efficiency and time resource management if you approach learning guitar that way. You enjoy playing the guitar, whether it's practicing or noodling or whatever you like to. You get good because you're enjoying the thing that you're doing at that moment and the next. Then it may emerge that you wind up with a talent or a style or an audience or money or success. Those things may emerge, and you don't have to worry about it if you're enjoying the process. And that's you're the podcast example of that, and a good one, a really, really good one.
Well, thank you. And that's the thing. I enjoy my work and I enjoy the podcast. I mean, that's why I grind so hard on it, is because it's enjoyable.
That's right.
I mean, I don't mind sitting there for 2 hours working on editing something or bringing in. I brought in some buddies now that are on the staff that are, you know, Joe from Anatomy is producing this show and doing the editing. So a lot of times I just have to record the interview, send it to him, kind of give him a rough idea of what I'm looking for, and it comes out the other end.
Yeah.
And he loves doing it, and he does it for free. It's awesome.
Yeah, and I would.
A good way for us to stay connected.
I want to point out to you that even that in itself is a very important skill, and that is project managing or human development. There's negotiation involved in that. It's management. You know that what you're doing there to get your buddy. I mean, it's not like he's on salary with medical or anything. I doubt you even really pay him. Or even if you do, I'm sure it's not much. And so you found some way to motivate and incentivize and collaborate with somebody in a structure that you're also creating. Yep. And that's a skill worth learning too. How to interface with other people, how to do collaborative projects together. And that's all. And then your verbal skills and your networking skills. And you're really amazing at finding and booking guests. You helped me get guests and it's tremendous. Some of my best guests I've ever had, you either found them or sent them to me or whatever it is. And so all those things are skills that just come along, and they completely overlap. So whether you ever are a professional podcast or not, it's just totally beside the point, almost.
I'm just enjoying it. It's just a journal for me, basically, and a bunch of snapshots of where I was, and you know, for my kids and stuff, it's a big deal. Like I can just scroll through the old episodes and be like, man, you know, Grayson's going to love listening to this one at one point, you know, if we talk about this.
You know, I've never even thought about that. Cool. My kids will eventually go back and listen, I guess. They're not old enough to really listen. I don't even know what age would be appropriate, but I imagine it'll – maybe they won't care. Well, I haven't even thought about that with my music. Will they go back and listen to it and like it, or will it just be – will I force them to do it and they won't care? What you think?
Well, that's
be?
The thing. Like Toby's kids, Toby and Devin's kids, are going to be able to hear their voice.
That's true.
I mean, you've done some vocal stuff, but they're going to hear you. If they want to hear you speak and hear Dad's voice when you're gone, this is what they're going to come to, and they're going to have so much content. And you know, I hate using that word content too, but I mean, they're going to have so many hours. I mean, I have hours of tapes of my dad's old radio show he did in Petersburg when I first started discovering music, like going with them on Thursday nights for a Friday release and sitting in the record room playing records so I wouldn't make any noise in his room.
Man.
And I go listen. I can still listen to those tapes. I mean, hearing your dad when he's in his 30s, like it's awesome.
Well, that makes me sound sad. They'll listen to me talking on this. Listen to this when I'm dead. Hey, Georgia. Hey, Jerry. His dad.
Yeah. It's like Herrera said, if you're listening to this today or 10,000 years from now, hello.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, right? Like, I'm long gone now, yeah. But great-grandkids yeah. I've never met. I love you. I wish I could have met you. Take this episode with Dewey Halpas, and, you know, I did the best I could. I'm sorry for my shortcomings. Forgive. That's what I have to say. Let me suggest an alternative that is a little more optimistic. I will have thousands of hours logged of my voice, my mannerisms, uh-huh. my points of view, my mind essentially dumped into some audio format. So when all the other technologies are good enough and the AIs are good enough, I suppose they will just simply be able to use this archive and recreate a bot of me that's realistic. So when I'm gone, they can just have grandpa walk in a room at age 30 and interact with them the way he would have. They won't have to be on iPods going back to listen to this. They'll actually have a hologram or a bot literally extrapolate the rest of what I would have said in whatever situation. And it won't be exactly me, but it'll be very close. And it will actually go, and these kids can ask. My kids' kids will be able to ask a hologram of me a question, and the AI will be able to give them an accurate answer in real time.
Yeah.
They'll be able to interact with an artificial intelligence version of me, perhaps, because I've logged all this.
Sure, and you can take it one step further. There's a guy that had got diagnosed with ALS, and there's this new technology that they let him use, and as he was deteriorating, this is sad, of course, but he was saying all these different phrases, and they were recording them.
Uh-huh.
So now he can control.
Oh, that's great.
He can't speak now. But he can say things to his kids in his voice because they have all that audio.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many cool things.
Yeah, I'm going to start doing that. Say, get off that damn couch.
Yeah.
And then when I lose the ability to
get
say
off
it.
The shed.
Yeah, right. Then I can play that back when I no longer have my verbal capacities. That's good.
Get off the shed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You and Will Ferrell.
No, I don't know. Who knows? But yeah, there's going to be consequences of these types of things. That's what's always fun about a new medium is you just never know. You're just throwing stuff out there and you're doing it. And that's some of the biggest monumental stuff that's ever happened was people doing stuff that they had no clue what the results, ramifications, or future uses of it were. They were just back to process. They're doing what they're doing. And then the discovery comes, or something explodes out of it, or something it's utilized for a different purpose than they ever had, you know, intentionally in the first place. And it could be amazing.
Yeah.
So at least by making podcasts and media, you have a chance of something happening with it.
Yep.
Like success or not success, but whatever. But that all those things should just be emergent. They're not the goal. They're just possible outcomes that could be positive. And it usually seems like there's very little negatives to creating things. Like, I mean, atomic bomb perhaps is bad. There's a few that are bad, but for most creativity, seems to be more of a chance that creative things are typically positive. I never thought that through before this moment, but it seems at this time it seems reasonable that would be the case.
Sure. And think of all these ideas we come up with when we're podcasting and just chatting. I mean, all these idea generation is just crazy. I mean, the things you can come up with and just spitballing. I mean, it's awesome.
Yeah. So the telephone is really good, but these technologies and the formats here, it's just the way I look at it is I have access to your brain. Like, I can think through your point of view, like, I wonder how Dewey would do this. And I have access to that directly, and just I have a model of you in my head that I use to, if I want to think about something through his view or Reva's view or Toby's view, you know, and that's really useful to be able to interface this way and do it. So that's one thing. You're right. Just us having this conversation benefits me. I hope it benefits the listener. I believe it does, but I know it benefits me, and I enjoy catching up and talking to Dewey. So I couldn't be happier about what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's awesome, man. I love it. And this is, you and I, I wouldn't say lost touch, but we hadn't talked in a long time until the podcasting thing came back around, and it brought us back together. And you know,
absolutely,
it's awesome. It's just a, it's, there's, I don't see any negatives to podcasting at all.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to think. Cool, it's weird because there's a lot of negatives in the world, but the, you know, creativity is a good way to go if you can enjoy it, regardless of the outcome. But I know you're on your lunch break of your plumbing job, and
yes, sir.
I hope you have a few more minutes to get you a Jack in the Box taco and get back to work.
Oh, I do. I'm going to be fine.
All right, Dewey, thanks. I enjoyed talking to you today.
Hey, thanks a lot, man.
Come up to Seattle so we can do it in studio. It's even better. So let me know when you can come up.
I will.
You can stay with me, too.
All right, man.
All right.
Right on.
See you later.
All right, see you later.
You've been listening to the Jabberjaw Podcast Network, jabberjawmedia.com.
Hello, and welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo, and for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book, and together, we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our ninth season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.